This evening, dear brothers and sisters, we continue our series of character studies, and this week we are considering Abigail, and our brother Joel Toms is going to speak to us on that subject. He's requested that we read the chapter that is devoted to the story of Abigail, which is the first book of Kings, chapter 25, and I'll ask brother Matt Snelling to read that chapter to us. Well, with that introduction, we now ask Brother Joel to speak to us upon the character study of Abigail.
Well, good evening, dear brothers and sisters. So tonight we are to consider the woman Abigail. She was a wife, the third wife, or perhaps the second, of King David, a remarried woman. She was the mother of at least one of David's sons. She was mentioned by name 14 times, all in the Old Testament, as Abigail, David's wife, or Abigail of Carmel, or Abigail, widow of Nabal, the Calebite. But all the significant mentions of this Abigail cover a very small window of time in this chapter of the 1st of Samuel 25, which we've just read. There is one other woman of the same name, and that's Abigail, wife of Jether, the Ishmaelite, and she was the mother of Amasa, who was the commander of Absalom's army a little later on in Israel's history. But this is definitely a different person. The name Abigail means her father's joy, and for the most part, we will consider this Abigail of Carmel, the wife of David and the widow of Nabal, in the context of that much more familiar character, who is also much more well-documented, Israel's King David. So, let's look at the context, the historical time leading up to the time when we meet Abigail. Now, from the 1st of Samuel chapter 19, we read about David's flight from King Saul. And this is after David has spent some years in the faithful service of King Saul, with a number of great military exploits and showing unwavering loyalty. But despite this, in the 1st of Samuel 19, verse 1, Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David. Later from verse 9, an evil spirit from the Lord came on Saul as he was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand. While David was playing the lyre, Saul tried to pin him to the wall with his spear, but David eluded him as Saul drove the spear into the wall. That night, David made good his escape. Later on in this chapter, therefore, David flees death at the hands of the jealous and unstable King Saul. And we see the first place David fled was to the prophet Samuel, who had, of course, recently anointed David king in place of Saul. Verse 18 of that same chapter 19. When David had fled and made his escape, he went to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. Then he and Samuel went to Naioth and stayed there. Now, this Ramah is a very small town, around about 6 miles north of present-day Jerusalem. And Naioth, which is often translated habitations or dwellings, although the actual meaning is uncertain. The Naioth is a place close by to Ramah, and it's almost certainly a small school or college of prophets overseen by Samuel. So that's the first place David sought refuge, was with the prophet Samuel. In chapter 20, David is able to share his plight with his well-beloved friend Jonathan, Saul's son. Chapter 21, David seeks assistance from Ahimelech and the priests at Nob, and this place is also in the vicinity of Jerusalem. Later in that chapter, David pretends to be insane to seek refuge with Achish, king of Gath, and the Philistines. In the next chapter, David escapes Achish and he flees to the cave of Adullam. And this is also in the district of Jerusalem. And it's worth remembering at this time, of course, that the city of Jerusalem was not actually part of the nation of Israel. It was still occupied by the Jebusites, and David himself only captured it at a later time. as we've recently read in Joshua, chapter 15, verse 63, Judah could not dislodge the Jebusites who were living in Jerusalem. And later on in Judges 1, verse 21, the Benjamites, however, did not drive out the Jebusites who were living in Jerusalem. And it's at this time, in the cave of Adullam near Jerusalem, that David starts to gather his men, around 400 outcasts and discontented of Israel. So I suppose this part of David's life is the first time when he really begins to be a king in his own right. He's on the run, certainly, but he has men under his own command, and he is not himself under the command of another person. And there's a lot more exploits in the life of David before we meet Abigail. But let's skip to chapter 24. Chapter 24 is the first time David spares Saul's life in a cave in En-Gedi. And we remember that Saul's conscience is stung so as to relent from his pursuit. Verse 14 of that chapter. And it's worth having this open chapter around 1 Samuel 25, because we'll basically be going through that chapter today. Verse 14 of 1 Samuel 24, David speaking here. Against whom has the king of Israel come out? Who are you pursuing? A dead dog? A flea? May the Lord be our judge and decide between us. May he consider my cause and uphold it. May he vindicate me by delivering me from your hand. And so at this stage, Saul and David make a peace, although it is temporary. Verse 22, so David gave his oath to Saul, and that was not to wipe out Saul's descendants. Then Saul returned home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. So when we meet Abigail in chapter 25, which we've just read, it seems that David, although displaced as he was from the royal position which he was to assume, he was perhaps experiencing something of a reprieve. And in the very next chapter, chapter 26, we find that this was actually quite short-lived. But at least at this time, David was possibly not in imminent danger of death. We do, however, read at the very beginning of 1 Samuel 25 that the prophet Samuel died. And it seems, perhaps as a result of this change in the mind of Saul, that David himself might have been able to attend the mourning. Verse 1 of that chapter, now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him. And they buried him at his home in Ramah. Then David moved down into the desert of Paran. And so we remember how David's first point of refuge was with the prophet Samuel, chapter 19, verse 18. So of all the nation of Israel, we can only imagine that nobody felt this loss more keenly. Nevertheless, David moved on to the desert of Paran. Now, that desert of Paran, some manuscripts have Maon, which appears later in the chapter as well. Paran is in modern-day Saudi Arabia, some way south of Jerusalem and Ramah, where David had been. The desert of Paran is towards the west of the country, and therefore is on the eastern coast of the Red Sea. The town Maon is in the lowlands of Judah, so a lot closer to Ramah and where David had been. It's about 25 miles south of Jerusalem as the crow flies. The climate, as with much of the nation of Israel, is semi-arid, and so it's not suitable for arable farming, but it is adequate for pastoral farming of the hardier livestock like sheep and goats. So it's possible that David was on the way from Ramah, from Samuel's funeral, I suppose, to the desert of Paran, and he went via this country of Maon on his way south. And it's in this country of Maon where the town of Carmel is situated even to this day. It's not Mount Carmel on the coast, it's a different place in the lowlands of Judah. But in any case, David's journey from Ramah was probably in the region of at least 30 to 40 miles, depending on the terrain, depending on the specific route he took, which, of course, we're not told. And although David was not fleeing as such, he was still not settled as the king whom Samuel anointed to lead Israel. So at this point, David meets Abigail. But let us consider, apart from David, what we know of Abigail from this chapter, what we know about her circumstances. And we read about her in the second verse of this chapter 25. A certain man in Maon, who had property there at Carmel, was very wealthy. He had 1,000 goats and 3,000 sheep, which he was shearing in Carmel. His name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. She was an intelligent and beautiful woman, but her husband was surly and mean in his dealings. He was a Calebite. Now, from this quote, we learn a number of things. Firstly, the family was very wealthy. It mentions her husband as being very wealthy, but the family as a whole. And so perhaps we might consider that they would have been seen as a successful family in worldly terms. Secondly, Abigail herself was intelligent and beautiful, and I'm quoting from the NIV. The KJV, the King James Version, renders intelligent as of good understanding. And I think that's a little bit more descriptive in this case. Because that word good, it is two words in the Hebrew, that word good does imply a certain aspect of morality. Perhaps we might say then she had a moral intelligence. And doubtless these attributes, her physical beauty but also her character, would have been considered part of her husband's success. And thirdly, we read that that husband was an unpleasant character. In the version I'm using, is surly and mean. And it's strange that immediately when we meet Nabal, we encounter this contrast of characters. And I think it's fair to say it's very unusual to have this of a couple in Scripture. Mostly, when we talk about a married couple, if we need to, we use the Scripture, we use the husband to represent the two. Often enough, the wife is also named. Sometimes in genealogies we read of the mother, the wife of the man as the mother of the next in the line. We know that Abigail was to become David's wife, and so, of course, she's important for this reason. That might be why she's recorded particularly. And of all of David's wives, we only really know about two of them. David's first wife, Michal, daughter of Saul, and his third wife, or perhaps second, this Abigail of Carmel, who we're thinking about this evening. But this mention of her character clearly indicates that she was somehow unusual or even exceptional. And this is, of course, further emphasized by contrast with her husband. And it's quite easy to see these two starkly contrasting characters borne out in the rest of the chapter. So, David was camped at Carmel near the flocks of Nabal. And we find out from later in the chapter that he had made sure while he was there that his men, armed and disreputable as they were, nevertheless respected and protected the people and the property of Nabal's estate. And as a result of this, David makes what we might consider quite a reasonable request for charity. Verses 6 to 8. Of chapter 25, long life to you. This is what the message David sends to Nabal. Long life to you, good health to you and your household, and good health to all that is yours. Now I hear that it is sheep shearing time. When your shepherds were with us, we did not mistreat them, and the whole time they were at Carmel, nothing of theirs was missing. Ask your own servants, and they will tell you. Therefore, be favourable toward my men, since we come at a festive time. Please give your servants and your son David whatever you can find for them. So in fact, David is not really demanding anything from Nabal, and nor is he asking for help from someone who can ill afford it. He is simply asking for the excess of the vast wealth of the man by way of charitable giving. And when it mentions that it's a festive time, that's simply because the shearing of sheep in the spring was a time of festivity. It was a celebrated occasion in Israel's agricultural tradition. And, of course, it's not just charity, is it? It's a gesture of goodwill for a valuable service, which was freely given by David. But Nabal's response is extremely telling. Verse 10. Nabal answered David's servants, "Who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse? Many servants are breaking away from their masters these days. Why should I take my bread and my water and the meat I have slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men coming from who knows where?" Now, when Nabal asks, "Who is this David?" it is quite inconceivable that he had not heard of David's mighty exploits in battle or his faithful service to King Saul. His sole motivation in saying this was greed. Truly, he was, as his first introduction tells us, surly and mean in his dealings. And perhaps also, although he managed a large estate, which was, as we mentioned, successful in worldly terms, perhaps he was not very bright. David had, we read later on, David had about 600 armed men. And he took 400 of those, leaving the other 200 to guard his guard the camp. He took 400 of those in his response. And we don't know the size of Nabal's household, except in the amount of livestock, which we're told, 1,000 goats and 3,000 sheep. Another wealthy figure of the Old Testament, Abraham, had, we read, 318 trained men. And we read of that in the incident where the four kings of the valley captured his nephew Lot. We don't know how many sheep and goats Abraham had, so it's hard to compare the two. But David's force of 400 men would certainly be enough to worry any single landowner, even if they were not strictly outnumbered. And as a result of this, one of Nabal's servants has to talk to Abigail, Nabal's wife. Now, clearly, the servant understands the situation with David very clearly, a lot more clearly than his master. And his words about Abigail and Nabal are most telling. Verse 17. "Now think it over," he says to Abigail. "Think it over and see what you can do, because disaster is hanging over our master and his whole household. He is such a wicked man that no one can talk to him." So firstly, the servant asks Abigail to think it over and see what you can do, indicating that her wisdom and her ability to reason were plain to see. But also we see her good character, her obvious desire to put a situation right. The servant felt able to approach her, and he trusted her to do her best to help. But secondly, we see again a stark contrast with the man Nabal, who, unlike Abigail, who had been approached so readily, he was such a wicked man that no one could even talk to him. And Abigail's response here is perhaps where we see most clearly her own character. It's not any words she spoke, it's what she did as a result, and we know the saying, actions speak louder than words. Verse 18 of the chapter. "Abigail acted quickly. She took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 dressed sheep, 5 seahs of roasted grain, 100 cakes of raisins, and 200 cakes of pressed figs, and loaded them on donkeys. Then she told her servants, 'Go on ahead, I will follow you.' But she did not tell her husband Nabal." Clearly, the man Nabal was easily able to afford provisions for David's men. At no point do we hear that Nabal was even aware that this significant quantity of food had been removed from his household. Abigail did not complain about her husband's stupidity, or spend time fretting about the impending conflict with David's armed force. She took the action that her husband should have taken and made the necessary provisions available. But she did more than that. She also went to David in person to plead for the lives of her family and her servants. And in doing so, she put her life in considerable danger. At verse 20 of the chapter, we see as she came riding her donkey into a mountain ravine, there were David and his men descending toward her. And this, so she was approaching David, who'd set himself against her family, although perhaps he wouldn't have recognized her out of the blue. But she was walking down a mountain ravine, a dangerous place for any traveler, especially a woman riding alone on a donkey, although she had sent her servants in front of her. And so her faith and courage is so obvious here. Her faith, her courage to approach David in this way. And having put herself in harm's way, she entreats David to relent. And here in these words, we see her intelligence or her good understanding. The language she uses is incredibly powerful and at times even poetic. And it's from verse 23 to 31. I won't read it all. But she says things like, "Pardon your servant, my lord, and let me speak to you. Hear what your servant has to say. Please pay no attention, my lord, to that wicked man Nabal. He is just like his name. His name means fool, and folly goes with him." A little bit later on, "The Lord your God will certainly make a lasting dynasty for my lord, because you fight the Lord's battles, and no wrongdoing will be found in you as long as you live. Even though someone is pursuing you to take your life, the life of my lord will be bound securely in the bundle of the living by the Lord your God. But the lives of your enemies he will hurl away as from the pocket of a sling." And so on. At the end of her discourse, she pleads again, "And when the Lord your God has brought my lord success, remember your servant." Clearly she has a deeper faith and a knowledge of God's purpose with David. Even at this time when David was not established in the way which he was to be. And another thing which is notable here, perhaps slightly alarming, is how she talks about her own husband. We're perhaps accustomed to the idea, the ideal, of a man and a wife being a single unit, working together with mutual respect to strengthen one another. But Abigail clearly recognised her husband's inadequacies, and she was prepared to admit them to a stranger, albeit a well-known stranger who clearly had God's blessing and support. But we'll return to this at the end. David, for his part, was clearly struck by Abigail's plea and by her confession of her husband's folly. Verse 35, "Then David accepted from her hand what she had brought him and said, 'Go home in peace. I have heard your words and granted your request.'" So, Abigail returns home. From David's motley crew, scraping a living in the wilderness, making a powerful and poetic discourse, pleading for the lives of her family, she returns to a scene of her husband's self-indulgence and excess. Verse 36, "When Abigail went to Nabal, he was in the house holding a banquet like that of a king. He was in high spirits and very drunk." So this faithful woman could not speak to her own husband until the next morning. But when she did, verse 37, "Then in the morning when Nabal was sober, his wife told him all these things, and his heart failed him, and he became like a stone. About 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died." And we see fairly quickly that this was an act of mercy for this faithful woman. It opened the possibility of far greater things for her. Verse 39, "Then David sent word to Abigail, asking her to become his wife. His servants went to Carmel and said to Abigail, David has sent us to you to take you to become his wife. She bowed down with her face to the ground and said, I am your servant, and am ready to serve you and wash the feet of my Lord's servants. Abigail quickly got on a donkey, and, attended by her five female servants, went with David's messengers and became his wife. And what an amazing outcome that is for Abigail. I'm sure being the wife of a king can't be entirely straightforward. But from what we know of her former existence, I'm sure it was a step up in the things which mattered to her, for which she can only have been very thankful. So, over the course of no more than 2 weeks, this woman, Abigail, was moved from being the better half of her marriage to a thoroughly unpleasant man, to a widow with the favour of God's anointed King David. Ultimately, she became David's wife and the mother of his son, 2 Samuel 3. Sons were born to David in Hebron, including his second, Chileab, the son of Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And in the First of Chronicles, that Chileab is called Daniel. We assume they're the same person. And so, along the way, we've mentioned some of the things which we can draw from this account, but we will see, once again, what we can learn from it as a whole, by way of conclusion. Abigail was a woman of faith and excellent character, married to a man who was completely the opposite. How hard it must have been for her to want to be kind to others, to use her family's great means for good, and perhaps to share these aims with the man to whom she was married, but instead she experienced no such thing. A husband who refused kindness even to the Lord's anointed, and who was so drunk when she returned from her mission that she could not speak to him until the next day. But despite this, she was, as we might say, her own woman. She did not allow herself to be consumed by the inadequacies of her family, but rather she maintained an incredible resilience and faith in God, and the ability to show the generosity of spirit which she wanted to. Now, many of us in here are married. Some are not. Some are perhaps thinking about it. Many of us who are married, and those of us who are not, will be close to someone. We'll know that married couples, people who are close, do not always agree. And this is not an easy situation, especially if the disagreement is about something close to the heart. But the example of Abigail shows that as individuals we can remain responsible for our own character and our own actions, even if we cannot change the people close to us. As Paul says to the Corinthians, and perhaps it's a slightly different emphasis, 1 Corinthians 7, verse 16, how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? So even if we're not married, and obviously, as I said, some of us aren't, we can take great encouragement from the example of Abigail as a faithful individual in her own right. She kept a clear vision of what was right despite her circumstances. She acted with generosity and kindness towards those in need. And God's reward for her, even in this mortal life, was to take away her unhappiness in her previous marriage and replace it with a part in the life of David, Israel's king, the man after God's own heart, who received those great promises concerning our Lord and Master Jesus Christ. So let the example of Abigail serve to encourage all of us in our service of God, that our good deeds, our good intentions, are noticed by our Heavenly Father, and that he will do what is necessary to strengthen us to serve him, and that therefore in his mercy he will be pleased to grant us places in his glorious kingdom.